Before we start, I want to tell you about another podcast I'm enjoying, Face Off, United States versus China. It's about how the two nations, once friends, are now foes, and why things are so complicated now. The host, Jane Perlez, was Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. On Face Off, she talks with diplomats, spies, cultural superstars like Yo-Yo Ma, and more. You can listen to Face Off, the US versus China, wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for joining me again. I'm James Curran. I'm Professor of Modern History here at Sydney University and also the International Editor at the Australian Financial Review, where I write regularly about Australia in world affairs. As we saw in the previous episode, the retreat of Britain and America from the region at the end of the East Asian Cold War forced Australia to redefine itself in relation to Britain and to reassess its relationship with the United States. As a result, Australia, recognising the limits of the American alliance, began to focus its energies on the Asia-Pacific region in a new way. Today, we're going to look first at the foundations of Australia's new approach to Asia, which the Whitlam and Fraser governments laid down from 1972 to 1983. And then I'll look at the Australian response to Indonesia's desire to annex East Timor as a case study illustrating some of the complexities associated with this new approach to Asia. It's worth taking note of two points of clarification about the language of this new departure in Australian foreign policy. Firstly, when the Australians talked of Asia, they normally meant East Asia, that is, the Western Pacific, including all the countries from Korea through China and Japan to Southeast Asia, which they generally thought of as stretching as far west as Myanmar. Secondly, when the Australian government, in conjunction with the Japanese, began at the end of the 1980s to organise the region for their proposed Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Movement, they spoke of the Asia-Pacific, and so extended the boundaries of the region to include the United States and Canada. So let's look at how Whitlam and Fraser pioneered Australia's new Asian policy. Both the Whitlam and Fraser governments in the 1970s were agreed that their governments should give first priority to developing relations with the region. Labor and Liberal leaders and their parties were united in this endeavour. When Gough Whitlam, for example, set out his foreign policy objectives, he said that his government's prime foreign policy task, apart from protecting Australia's security, would be to foster regional cooperation. Hitting out at his predecessors, he maintained that neither ideological assumptions, such as anti-communism, nor military alliances, in particular CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organisation, would play any part in this new policy. The Fraser government endorsed this new attitude. For Andrew Peacock, the foreign minister in the Fraser government, he said,
"Our regional relationships, together with our relationship with the Western democracies and Japan, lie at the heart of our foreign policy."
So Australia's ties to America and the West were still important, but now Australia's direct relations with the region were given equal billing. Australia, however, had to work on how to be accepted in Asia. Though Asia was composed of many countries with many different cultures, nevertheless all the Asian peoples were united by one common historical experience, that is, the struggle to achieve their independence from Western imperialism. While Australia had not itself been part of that process, it was, in the eyes of Asians, tainted by association. Peacock endeavoured to address this problem by assimilating Australia's own history and circumstances to those of Australia's Asian neighbours. He told an Asian conference in 1978,
"We are one of the few Western countries with a colonial history. We depend heavily on primary commodities. Furthermore, our immediate political strategic environment is quite different from Western powers. Located in the Asia-Pacific region, Australia's regional relationships are with third world countries."
Now, this was an extraordinary distortion of history. The Australian government felt the necessity to make this rhetorical effort to connect, to belong. Whether he convinced any of his listeners is another question. Sometimes Australia worked too hard at trying to become Asian. The permanent head of the Foreign Affairs Department in the Whitlam years, Alan Renouf, entering into the spirit of things, even suggested that Australian diplomats should, like Asians and Africans, adopt a form of dress which would visibly separate them from other Westerners. He suggested that Australian diplomats should for this purpose wear Mao-style safari suits with golden wattles emblazoned on the collars. But this plan did not see the light of day, and officials are still looking for the mock-ups somewhere in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. One mischievous political commentator writing at the time asked whether, if the new diplomatic rig did not eventuate, Australian ambassadors at overseas posts might be asked to greet arriving guests with cries of cooey or serve fried witchetty grubs as hors d'oeuvres. More substantially, the Whitlam government's first step was to remove the major domestic obstacle to acceptance. He formally announced the end of the White Australia policy, and with it, that Asian migrants would be welcome on the same terms as applied to Europeans. Similarly, he ordered Australia's ratification of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. And he followed this up with the passage of a Racial Discrimination Act, outlawing discrimination against any Australian citizen on the basis of race, colour, descent, or national or ethnic origin. As part of this process of ridding Australia of the Western imperial legacy, Whitlam also gave New Guinea its independence and so freed Australia from its own colonial burden. Likewise, responding to Third World sensitivities, the Whitlam government took a public stand against white supremacy and apartheid in southern Africa. The Fraser government took this further, and Fraser himself, through CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, had an important role in bringing about the end of white minority rule in what was then known as Rhodesia. And with his help in 1980, the white settlers were persuaded to capitulate. Zimbabwe was freed from its imperial past. Fraser also, like Whitlam, expressed support for the North-South debate, which had been initiated by the Third World countries as a means of raising the living standards in undeveloped countries, many of whom were to be found in the Southern Hemisphere. In dealing more specifically with the region, Gough Whitlam had recognised the People's Republic of China on its own terms. That is, Australia ceased to have diplomatic relations with the Chinese nationalist government in Taiwan. Taiwan was not seen any longer as a bulwark against the expansion of Asian communism, but as an obstacle to good relations with the most populous and powerful nation in East Asia. Likewise, Whitlam recognised the communist governments of North Korea and North Vietnam, and when the Viet Cong captured Saigon in 1975, he hastened to recognise the new regime. He was responding to what the Australians had come to accept as the new reality of the region. He knew that communists could be nationalists. For him, China was a potential stabilising influence, as well as a growing market for Australian exports. And by 1979, China was the fourth largest destination for Australian exports. Fraser likewise courted China. Unlike his conservative predecessors, his first major overseas visits were not to London and Washington, but to Beijing and Tokyo. This departure from tradition was a symbol of changed priorities. When he was asked by journalists to explain why he had chosen to visit Japan and China before London and Washington, his response was simple yet striking. He said,
"The world changes."
Much like Whitlam, Fraser was now saying that ideology could not be a factor in how Australia dealt with other countries. And taking a leaf out of the Whitlam notebook, he said that the option of
taking you back to simplistic pasts, a relationship with Britain or a relationship with America that was almost the end result of foreign policy.
He added, things were just
much more complex, more difficult.
Fraser, however, had a less optimistic view of the end of the Asian Cold War than Whitlam. He did understand that the international system was no longer a bipolar one, in which the world was divided ideologically between the East and West, but he recognised the emergence of a multipolar system. In this new power structure, it was the Soviet Union's ambitions, as it sought new influence in Indochina and the Indian Ocean, which was the primary danger for the West and therefore for Australia. Therefore, on Fraser's first visit to Beijing in June of 1976, he informally suggested to his hosts that they should consider joining the Americans, Japanese and the Australians in a four-power pact, a quad if you like, aimed at curbing the hegemonic tendencies of Moscow. It was a bold move, made without any prior consultation with the Americans or indeed with the Japanese. The Chinese shared the same concerns about Russian expansionism. In essence, Fraser was saying that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Now, the Chinese appreciated the Australian intent, but the complexities involved in bringing the four powers together was too great, and so the demarche, Fraser's plan, came to nothing. His actions also provoked a minor diplomatic storm. British officials argued that in taking sides with China in the Sino-Soviet dispute, Fraser, they said, had broken ranks with those of his Western colleagues who visited China recently, including the British Foreign Secretary at the time, Anthony Crossland. What was particularly irksome for Whitehall officials, however, was Fraser's criticism of détente. The British had been aware for some time of the dangers, they said, of speaking with more than one voice to the Chinese, who, as Fraser himself seems to have implied, are not past exploiting this kind of thing, was the view of British officials in London. They also sensed that the Chinese, however, did not share the same sense of triumph in the visit as Fraser did. Seizing on the fact that the zoological exchange that the Australians negotiated with the Chinese during the visit had received almost no publicity. In exchange for a pair of wombats, a pair of large grey kangaroos, a pair of wallabies, and seven pairs of birds, the Australians, they noted, only got one pair of lesser pandas, one pair of pangolins, and a pair of raccoon dogs. The British, this was nothing special, they said.
The last two species can be obtained in any number of countries, and lesser pandas are not a patch on the real thing.
For this diplomat, at least, it was eloquent testimony that the Chinese had not put all their eggs in Malcolm Fraser's basket. Nevertheless, it was a mark of the new era. What had happened to the Australian perception of China as the source of all insurgencies and disturbance in the region? Moreover, before 1972, no Australian government would have ventured on such a course without first clearing it with the British or the Americans. Now, the era that I'm talking about also saw a great step forward in Australia's relations with Japan. By the 1970s, the fears and antagonisms associated with the Second World War were, for most Australians, left behind. Apart from any other reason, Japan had become too important to Australia's economic well-being. Since the 1950s, trade with Japan had grown exponentially. Over the succeeding decades, it had become Australia's most important market. And from 1960 to 1980, Australian-Japanese trade had increased fivefold. Japan had taken Britain's place as Australia's most important trading partner. Indeed, the role of Britain and Japan as markets for Australian products had been reversed. So in the mid-1950s, Britain had taken about one-third of Australian exports. By the mid-1970s, its share had fallen to 4%. On the other hand, whereas Japan had only taken 6% of Australian exports in the mid-1950s, by the mid-1970s, its share rose to 34%, settling in the 1980s to around 25%. The two economies meshed very neatly. As Japan's industrialisation proceeded apace, Australia's exports to the country moved from being primarily agricultural and pastoral to mineral and energy resources. The two economies complemented each other and made the two countries mutually dependent on one another. Now, the intensity of the relationship led from time to time suspicions about resource diplomacy, that is, one or the other using its advantage in the world market at the expense of the other. But by the mid-1970s, Australian and Japanese leaders were desirous of putting the relationship on a firmer foundation, and they negotiated a treaty which was intended to give confidence to both sides and extend the connection beyond trade to regional diplomacy and cultural understanding. Whitlam, when he visited Japan in 1973, set the process in train, and in June 1976, Prime Ministers Fraser and Japanese Prime Minister Miki signed the NARA Basic Treaty of Friendship and Cooperation. While the treaty specifically acknowledged Australia and Japan's mutual interest in each being a reliable supplier to and market for the other, and in the development of mineral and energy resources, it was also to be an umbrella instrument which would provide a framework for the whole relationship. The Department of Foreign Affairs said it had put the relationship
on a new level of intimacy and certitude.
And under its auspices, Canberra established an Australia-Japan Foundation to further cultural exchange and understanding. Australia and Japan, with their ties to the United States, shared a common interest in the stability of the Asia-Pacific region. In 1980, Prime Ministers Fraser and O'Hara agreed that the creation of a Pacific community was a long-term objective. The NARA Treaty was the first general bilateral treaty that Australia had entered into with an Asian power, and it became a model for similar treaties, which Australia subsequently negotiated with Indonesia and other Asian countries. But Australia's main interest in this period was the cultivation of ASEAN, that is, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which had been formed in 1967. ASEAN was the brainchild of Indonesia. After crushing the communists, the Suharto regime had taken the initiative in establishing an organisation for the region, which would have as its foundation members, in addition to itself, of course, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, and the Philippines. Though its principal functions were economic, scientific, technical, cultural, and social, for Indonesia it was also a response to fears about communist success in Vietnam and the expansion of Chinese communist influence in Southeast Asia. Other members did not want to provoke the Chinese and to insist that it did not have a political character. Indonesia, on the other hand, pressed for the inclusion in the founding declaration that foreign bases in the region were only temporary and that the nations of the region themselves had primary responsibility for the stability and security of Southeast Asia. And that was aimed almost as much at Western powers as at China and the Soviet Union. It was a search for Asian solutions for Asian problems. Keen to show its commitment to the region, the Whitlam government sought close links to ASEAN. It realised that Australia would not be welcome as a member, and so did not press for admission to the group. Apart from its Western connections, the ASEAN countries had some suspicion of Australia's burgeoning relationships with China and Japan. Indeed, the ASEAN countries wondered whether Australia's ties to these Northeast Asian giants might come at their expense. Nevertheless, in early 1974, Australia attended a meeting of ASEAN as an associate member, and at a meeting in Canberra in April 1974, Australian and ASEAN officials began the process of what was called dialogue partnerships. Australia sweetened its overtures with economic aid for ASEAN development projects, and in the new peaceful climate, trade boomed. From 1970 to 80, Australian exports to ASEAN countries increased at an annual rate of 18%, and by 1980, they were valued at $1 billion. The Fraser government pursued the same line, but achieved no more success in its attempt to be taken into the full confidence of the ASEAN countries. It was against this background that Australia was called on to frame a policy towards the future of Portuguese East Timor. The problems raised by the Portuguese move to rid itself of its colonial dependencies brought to the fore the fact that this new Australian policy, aimed at cooperation and acceptance in the region, had its complexities and difficulties. In April 1974, a socialist military coup in Portugal brought to power a radical government which was intent on giving independence to all Portugal's overseas colonies, including East Timor. With the withdrawal of Portuguese police and military from the colony, Timorese were free to manoeuvre politically for a solution as to their future, and rival parties began to organise in preparation for seizing power. In Australia, Gough Whitlam took personal control of the matter and pursued a policy which in effect meant that Australia favoured Indonesia taking over East Timor. At a meeting with President Suharto in September of 1974, Whitlam set aside a departmental briefing paper which advised him to warn the Indonesians against adopting a, quote,
forward policy which would place Australian interests at risk
and be contrary to the wishes of the people of Portuguese Timor. Rather, Whitlam told Suharto, quote,
Portuguese Timor should become part of Indonesia.
Even though, he added,
this should happen in accordance with the properly expressed wishes of the people of Portuguese Timor.
It was Whitlam's view that East Timor was too small to be a viable state. He thought that East Timorese independence would be, quote,
unwelcome to Indonesia, Australia, and to other countries in the region.
In order to satisfy Australian public opinion, however, Indonesian annexation of the territory should, Whitlam said, quote again,
appear to be a natural process arising from the wishes of the people.
Now, Gough Whitlam never addressed the question of what would constitute evidence of the properly expressed wishes of the Timorese people. He never canvassed the question of what Australia would expect Indonesia to do if East Timorese consent was not forthcoming. He never seems to have given thought to what Australia should do if Indonesia did annex the territory in clear defiance of the people's wishes. Now, these were questions of fundamental importance if Australia were seriously concerned to ensure that no change of sovereignty took place without the consent of the East Timorese people. In essence, however, the message was clear. Australia approved Indonesian takeover of East Timor, and it simply hoped that this could be done in a way which would not cause dissension and criticism in Australia. Certainly, that's the message that President Suharto understood Whitlam was conveying to him, and from both Whitlam's words and their context, it would seem that that reading was a fair one. The Indonesians had from the beginning tackled the Australian problem quite cleverly. They had kept Australian officials secretly informed of their thinking. By doing so, they put Australia in a difficult position. If the Australians protested against what the Indonesians were telling them and refused to listen further to these confidential briefings, they would offend their near neighbour and lose this privileged access to Indonesian plans. If, on the other hand, they continued to take part in these briefing sessions, the Indonesians could reasonably conclude that the Australians were tacitly giving their approval to their plans. Whitlam had no desire to take a stand. He would not order his officials to stop participating in these secret briefing sessions. Thus, Australia was increasingly compromised, and it lost control, if it ever had control, over its own policy. Whitlam certainly gave hostages to fortune. It's difficult to understand why Whitlam allowed hope to dictate to judgment. It's difficult to know altogether why a Prime Minister with an acute intelligence like Whitlam's put forward a policy which could only confuse and produce a politically embarrassing outcome. It would appear that at the core of his thinking was the belief that Indonesia was the key to Australia's future acceptance in the region. Of all Asian nations, Indonesia was best placed to cause damage to Australia. Whitlam had, he said, no desire to allow another West New Guinea-type crisis to trouble the relationship. This big man liked big states. He appeared to believe that many or small states were inherently unstable and attracted trouble. And perhaps too, Whitlam or his advisers feared that an independent East Timor might, like Portugal's African colonies, come under Marxist influence, and if so, perhaps allow Chinese communism a foothold in the region. Certainly the Indonesians and the Americans entertained such suspicions. For Whitlam, it simply made sense that this little unreconstructed corner of European imperialism should come under the tutelage of Indonesia. And Indonesia, certainly the military, had their minds set on achieving this end. But Whitlam went beyond merely acquiescing. As his critics have noted, he positively encouraged the Indonesians in their ambitions. Meeting Suharto in Townsville in April 1975, Whitlam gave the Indonesian leader further encouragement. Australian public opinion had been growing ever more vocal in opposition to an Indonesian takeover of East Timor, and the Indonesian leaders had become worried about a possible Australian backlash. Whitlam, however, reassured Suharto, telling him at the end of an exchange about Australian public opinion, he said,
"Our actions in regard to Portuguese Timor would always be guided by the principle that good relations with Indonesia were of paramount importance to Australia."
Indonesia, then using not too well disguised covert means, fomented internal strife in an effort to obtain a government in Dili, the capital of the old Portuguese colony, which would issue an invitation for military intervention. But the Indonesians' efforts rebounded on their heads. By September, Fretlin, an East Timorese Socialist Party, and the party most opposed to Indonesia, had defeated its rivals and was seizing power. The Indonesians then began to infiltrate commandos into East Timor to help undermine the new government. Though well aware of Indonesian actions, the Australian authorities publicly accepted their denials at face value. Whitlam, in Parliament, washed his hands of the whole matter by declaring, he said,
"Timor is in many ways part of the Indonesian world."
When then, on December the 7th, 1975, the Indonesians openly invaded East Timor, landing paratroops in Dili, it did so believing that it had the sanction of both Australia and the United States. Now, a lingering question here is to what degree Australia consulted with the United States on the East Timor question. What is known is that on the day before the invasion, the American President Gerald Ford and his Secretary of State Henry Kissinger were in Jakarta on an official visit. And in response to Suharto's request for understanding about the imminent invasion, President, that is Ford, replied that the American government understood. As the record of that conversation put it, Ford said, quote,
"We will understand and will not press you on the issue."
Henry Kissinger, ever the strategist, added, he said,
"It is important that whatever you do succeeds quickly."
For the Americans, Suharto's military regime was a stable anti-communist stronghold in Southeast Asia. And as in the case of West New Guinea, the Americans were quite willing to allow Indonesia to have its way with another, so to speak, 1,000 square miles of cannibal land. With the coming of the invasion, however, the difficulties inherent in the Australian position could no longer be repressed. The Fraser government, which had just been elected to office, was complicit in their predecessors' policies. But in the face of domestic and international outrage at this blatant act of aggression, the Fraser government had no choice but to condemn the action and to join in a unanimous UN resolution condemning it. Whitlam's confused policy had come home to haunt the Australians, and the Indonesians felt betrayed by Australia. They had been led to believe that Australia sympathised with their ambition to annex the territory. And when on the day Australia joined Indonesia's critics, it was felt deeply. Indeed, the irony was that if Australia had not encouraged Indonesia, then probably Indonesia would not have felt so bitter about the Australian stand. The Fraser government was deeply embarrassed. Publicly, it supported the United Nations position. And on the eve of Indonesia's formal integration of East Timor in July 1976, the government claimed that it had sought the withdrawal of the Indonesian troops from East Timor and a genuine process of self-determination for the people. Even so, the Fraser government began, after a decent interval to let the dust settle, to look for ways of mending its bridges with Jakarta. And so in January 1978, the Australian government recognised de facto Indonesia's integration of East Timor, and in early 1979, it quietly extended de jure recognition. Now that move had two practical advantages. It brought Australia's policy into line with the ASEAN states, and it was in harmony with the region. Richard Woolcott, who'd been Whitlam's closest ally in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Australian ambassador to Indonesia through the most critical times, argued that Australia could not afford to be seen in the region, quote,
as a misfit and a sort of Southeast Asian South Africa.
In Woolcott's view, the only alternative to a continuing deterioration in Australia's relationship with Indonesia was to accept what had been done, to put the issue behind them. Even more, though, Australia's action in recognising Indonesia's annexation of East Timor helped smooth the negotiations just about to begin over the division of the Timor seabed, which was thought then to be very rich in oil and gas resources. Now, large sections of the Australian public continued to be concerned about their government's collusion in recognising this act of aggression against a small neighbouring people. The Australian critics were a strange coalition of voices. Radicals opposed the Indonesian military regime's overthrow of the socialist Fretlin government. Liberal Democrats denounced the Indonesians for refusing to allow the people a genuine act of self-determination. Catholic bishops and some leading liberal laymen attacked the Indonesian actions out of fear that a Muslim Indonesia would discriminate against the Catholic Timorese. Special groups like Australian ex-servicemen who'd served in East Timor in World War II, and journalists still aggrieved and affronted by the Indonesian massacre of their colleagues in Balabo on the border of East and West Timor, also condemned the Indonesians. And yet both the Whitlam and Fraser governments were unmoved by this public criticism. They and most of their advisers in the Foreign Affairs Department were agreed on a pragmatic course, which meant accepting what could not be undone. At the centre of the state, then, there was a consensus which withstood all the public backlash. Now, out of office, the Labor Party had disowned Whitlam's policy, and in 1977, it adopted a policy of self-determination for the East Timorese. Yet when the Hawke Labor government came to power in 1983, Bill Hayden, then Foreign Minister, shelved the policy and continued the line established by his predecessor. Hayden explained, in justifying himself, that East Timor was, quote,
a classic instance of the apparently straightforward moral choice having potentially catastrophic consequences for all.
What does that mean? Now, I've detailed the East Timor problem at some length here for two reasons. First, because it raises some fundamental issues for Australia in its desire to be accepted by its Asian neighbours to become part of the region. How can Australians reconcile their Western-derived ideas of human rights with Asian sensibilities about security and community? How can Australia oppose the wishes of a great Asian neighbour intent on aggression when it has not the power, even if it has the will, to ultimately use force to assist the victims of aggression? Can Australia afford to risk losing the goodwill of its major neighbour in such circumstances? And if it cannot condone what's being done, and it cannot use force to prevent it, then what is the proper policy? That's the first reason for spending so much time on East Timor. The second reason, of course, is that the 1975-1978 story about the East Timor problem came undone in the late 1990s, And when we look later in this series at Australia's role in that undoing, we might be able, against that context, to reach a new and a better assessment of the original Australian policy. Thanks again for listening. I would also like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples for over 60,000 years who lived on, loved and dreamt about the lands on which I am speaking today. And I pay my respects to their present and future successors who continue to embody their affection for Australia and their enthusiasm for its well-being. This series is produced by Peter Adams for the School of Humanities at the University of Sydney.